I'm Christopher Lydon, distilling Afghanistan lessons from newlyweds who learned the hard way. New York Times reporter David Rode, held hostage by the Taliban for 7 months, and his wife, Kristen Mulvihill, who toughed out the wait in New York. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. So you wanted to get to know the Taliban, David Rode, and you wanted to get a Taliban perspective and voice into your book on the AFPAC war. But at what risk to life and limb? And when you paid the price just short of your life, how different did the war and the Taliban and even the job of journalism look to you and to your wife of just weeks when you slipped out of Kabul on a mission that you hadn't mentioned to her? The book you wrote together, A Rope and a Prayer, and the book tour and the reviews are all behind you now. I want to know what you're going to tell your child and your grandchildren someday about what you learned from the Taliban, about them and about us, too. I want to know how you answered the late Richard Holbrooke's questions when he first met you afterward. Who are they, he asked. Why are they fighting? What do they want? And there are lots more questions after that one.
It was very stark, and I want to emphasize that the Haqqani network, which kidnapped me, you know, they believe that they are defending Afghanistan from a vast Christian, Hindu, Jewish conspiracy to obliterate Islam from the face of the earth. They think American soldiers are forcibly converting Afghan Muslims to Christianity, that American soldiers are forcing Afghan women to work as prostitutes on U.S. military bases. And, they see themselves as under siege, and they are simply defending their faith and their culture from this unwarranted and incredibly vicious foreign assault. And their kind of cartoonish, view of us was one of the, things that was most depressing to me from the captivity. I don't think all Afghans or Pakistanis believe it. I don't think the vast majority of them believe those things, but it was very, very stark.
Kristen, what's your view after all this about who they are, what they're fighting for, what they want?
The group holding David was really, I would say, a group of businessmen, masquerading as a pious religious movement. I will say their strength was that they had infinite patience. We thought they'd hold David indefinitely. They would contact the family. They were demanding initially $25 million and 15 prisoners from Guantanamo. And they would contact us periodically, but they would go silent, for 6 to 8 weeks at a time. And that was really difficult for us. But they had, we felt, all the time in the world to hold David. So I guess their patience really stands out for me. And then I guess the hypocrisy, they were calling me asking for millions of dollars and then asking me to return the call because they didn't want to pay for the phone call. So that was a bit of humor thrown into the mix. But they would also say things, we're going to call and find out about your progress, but we're going to go off and pray for a few days and then you can, update us on what you've raised. So
that's a different view from David's. I mean, what do you make of their religion and their religious paranoia?
It's not just that I don't want to disagree with my wife. We're going to definitely disagree here.
Yeah, we are. Very different, somewhat different experiences.
we are full of contradictions, but they were absolutely full of contradictions as well. So they told me that they were on this, pious effort to defend themselves from this foreign assault. But over time, it was obvious that it was about money. And for the specific, I think the young guys believe all that propaganda about defending, their culture and their faith. But the older commanders were very much businessmen. It was very much about getting as much money and as many prisoners as possible to boost their standing among other Taliban.
But money for what? It wasn't for Mercedes-Benzes. Presumably, it was for more war.
No, it was for their families. It was flat out greed. I mean, I'm not trying to sort of, again, I'm specifically talking about my kidnappers. It was flat out, money. Some of it would clearly go to the war effort, but it was about personal greed.
And I was actually told by an individual who lives in Pakistan who helped out on our case that, they later found out from earlier cases, the kidnappers actually would use the money to try to go to Dubai. you know, to buy residency in Dubai for their families. So for some of them, it was about getting out of the country.
Weren't you a little bit surprised, David, that Richard Holbrooke, at the very top of the policymaking structure, was asking you, who are they and what do they want?
Yes and no. I mean, the Haqqanis are the most, you know, one of, if not the most effective Taliban faction. So I could, you know, understand his curiosity. But I do think that there is a problem where the United States doesn't know the Taliban well. It isn't clear, you know, what they want. And I also think there's many different factions, so it's hard to kind of lump them all into one place. You know, as we talk this morning, you'll see again, you know, I'll have contradictory descriptions of who they are and what they want. They would complain to me that, you know, you Americans are forcibly converting our people to Christianity, and then they would try to forcibly convert me to Islam. They would complain that, you know, you Americans make Afghans dress like they're Westerners, and then they would try to force me to dress as they dressed, as the Prophet did. You know, there was constant sort of contradiction in their own activities. And look, we're guilty of the same thing ourselves. It was just it's a very odd sort of alternate reality they live in. And as I said, the vast gulf between how, you know, what we think we're doing over there and what they think we're doing. So it's just amazing.
Were there any points at which you felt a kind of personal kinship, the things where you could agree on, things you could pray to the one God together?
As a group, they would never consider praying to another God. They were emphatic about, you know, basically only believing in Islam, and that was it. You know, the
but
best
there
gods,
is only there is only one God, and the God of Islam is the God of the Judeo-Christian Bible, right?
Christians and Jews are going to hell. I was told I was going to go to hell unless I converted to Islam. I mean, I had one commander in particular, who was a senior commander, saying it was. His belief wasn't that God judges us all as individuals. He felt that if there was anybody sinning in basically across Afghanistan, because I asked him, will you compromise? Would you allow sort of strict law in like southern or conservative rural areas and something more liberal in the cities? And he said, absolutely not. That, you know, God orders him, he believed, to stop sin. And you first have to try to stop it with your hand. If that doesn't work, you try to stop it with your tongue, as in you say something to the sinner, and if that doesn't work, you try to stop it with your mind, and you pray that the sinning stops. So he believed that if there's one person in a village sinning, the entire village will be punished for that sin, and the entire village will go to hell. They were very, very deeply religious people and religious fundamentalists, and we sort of forget that, I think. So he just believed it was his religious duty to, you know, that I had to convert to Islam, that he has to make all of Afghanistan under strict Islamic law, or he himself, you know, would potentially go to hell.
David and Kristen, I want to ask you a different question, but I think one that your grandchildren someday are going to ask you. Why are we Americans in Afghanistan? What are we doing there? What's our role, really?
I would say we're... first of all, trying to belatedly and not even consciously kind of clean up the mess we created in the 1980s when we unleashed fundamentalist Islam in that region. Secondly, or maybe most importantly, it is about oil and keeping the region secure and energy supplies to the United States. But it's really, this is, you know, we created this movement, you know, to this history well. Many people do in terms of, you know, the anti-Soviet jihad.
A lot of people
so
don't.
It's one of the ironies of this case is that the Haqqani family kidnapped me. The patriarch of the family, who's now elderly and not really involved in what's happening, is Jalaluddin Haqqani. He was funded by the United States, by the CIA, during the anti-Soviet jihad. He also was very clever. He also had money coming from the Saudis. He invited Arab fighters. Jalaluddin Haqqani met Osama bin Laden when he first arrived in the area. And so the father, the patriarch, kind of played all sides. He, while spending time with Osama bin Laden, took an American congressman, Charlie Wilson, as in Charlie Wilson's War, the fantastic book and movie. And he and his men took Charlie Wilson over the border. Gave him a tour of Mujahideen actions against the Soviets, let Charlie Wilson fire a barrage of rockets at a Soviet base, And Wilson was absolutely, thrilled and sort of enthralled with the Afghans. And after the trip, he called Jalaluddin Haqqani goodness personified. Jalaluddin Haqqani's sons kidnapped me. They now despise the United States. And in a generation, their view of us, our view of them has completely changed. You know, but we were happy when, you know, Islamic fundamentalists were killing Soviets, and we're unhappy now when they're killing Americans.
I hear it quite differently about Charlie Wilson's war. We would play with any partner that would help us get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. We supplied stingers to the Haqqani network. As you say, he called him goodness personified. But so many Pakistanis have told us in a variety of conversations lately that the war, the fanaticism, the guns came to Pakistan and Afghanistan from America. It was an American idea. The whole thing we're fighting now was thought up in Ronald Reagan's America.
I would largely agree. I mean, it also came from Saudi Arabia. I mean, in terms of the Wahhabism, but yes, absolutely. And you know, we started it, and it's come back to bite us, so to speak. You know, I understand their frustration and agree with it. The only – I would say we absolutely created it in the 80s and fomented it, and then we walked away in the 90s. I do think there's a responsibility that the Pakistani military, which was very much our partner in creating it in the 80s, continued funding these fundamentalist groups throughout the 1990s, saw them as their great way to thwart India. They thought, oh, we've, you know, defeated the Soviets with this tool. And so they continued spreading fundamentalism in their own country through the 90s. And I've kind of argued it's sort of a joint problem that we are responsible in the 80s, you know, but they happily kept it going and vastly expanded it, particularly the number of madrasas through the 90s. And I absolutely, have had an amazing experience in Pakistan. I completely agree with the frustration among many Pakistanis about the lack of civilian power. And, you know, the ISI, the main intelligence branch of the Pakistani military, has created enormous problems for that country with our assistance, with our backing. So I, you know, never blame all Pakistanis, never say Pakistan is hopeless. In my mind, you know, it's always, you know, how do you diminish the influence of the ISI? How do you diminish the influence of the Pakistani military? Over the long term, that's what's going to help stabilize the whole region.
What if you just stop paying them $1 billion a year, which we have been doing? I mean,
we just agreed to increase it actually to $2 billion a year, which amazed me. And I raised this with a senior American official, and they basically told me it was off the table. And I said to this official, they just have us over a barrel, you know. And the person basically nodded, meaning, there is such fear, I believe, in at least for this one government official, that the Pakistanis, if we cut the aid, will stop cooperating, will block drone strikes, and the result will be a terrorist attack in the United States, and that will be devastating politically to any administration. So in a sense, this smaller country that we're giving billions of dollars has us over a barrel. They outbluff us. You know, We are afraid of cutting off this aid because they'll stop cooperating. They need that aid. The Pakistani military needs that aid, but they just, you know, they seem to be better poker players than we are.
Well, they have us over our barrel, so to speak. I mean, this is where the contradictions begin to come very, very threatening, but they also take on a kind of absurdity. And it's also where, I don't know, I have so many questions I want to push about the contradictions. I want to just say, though, parenthetically, and not just in full disclosure, in full admiration and affection for you, David. I knew him before you did, Kristen. I've known and admired you, David, for 20 years since you were an undergraduate at Brown and you came to intern at our 10 o'clock news on public television in Boston. And I've read your bylines ever since with a kind of fatherly pride. And you were on my prayer list, believe me, in Bosnia in captivity and through those months in Afghanistan. And it was a very serious thing among those friends of yours who knew and didn't want to say a word about the spot you were in. And having said that and meaning it, I also want to just push back on some of these conclusions and in a certain sense question The old newspaper line is, you know, did you bury the lead? The lead in certain ways on your story of 9/11 was, okay, David Rode, okay, America, okay, world, how do we confront religious extremism? And it's a question that you come back to at the end. To me, the question that comes out of your own book, David, is how do we contain the damage of our own policies, our own, you know, military adventures, our own tendency toward a kind of national, sometimes religious fanaticism abroad, especially now when it's not only coming back and hitting us in the face, but it just shows signs of getting dramatically worse. And a lot of this problem began in our country. The Pakistanis keep telling me that, but that's the message of Charlie Wilson's war too. A rogue congressman from Texas and a rogue CIA officer dreamed up this holy war, and they paid for it with Saudi money and American intelligence and American weapons. And it's that, as much as religious extremism at least, that constitutes a real threat now.
I agree. I mean, it's, you know, and the funny thing we were talking about earlier with sort of the fear of attacks in the U.S. is that there's, I mean, this is such a funny or this sort of distant war that affects so few Americans. And I mean, you know, it's no, I'm not saying an attack in the U.S., you know, is acceptable in any form, but there's such a low threshold for American life being disrupted. There's such a low threshold. People don't want to hear that this is our fault. So the narrative becomes, you know, you skip the part in the beginning about who helped create the religious extremism. You just talk about eliminating the religious extremism. But it's this oddly we're completely focused on this and there can't be a single attack, you know, yet we're not – there isn't a sort of sense of national sacrifice and that we might have to – endure to, you know, make up for these past errors. It was always odd for me to go, you know, keep going back and forth between Afghanistan and Pakistan and the U.S.
I also think very few Americans, actually, for all the success of Tom Hanks's movie and George Crowe's book on Charlie Wilson's war, very, very few Americans understand that this whole jihad, the Mujahideen, in a certain sense, the Taliban and al-Qaeda were American inventions to use against the Soviet and then, after the fall of the Soviet Union, basically to forget them. Did you know, Kristen, how this war was being cooked up in the 80s? I didn't.
I did, actually. And I mean, we tried everything throughout his captivity. I tried to, you know, get a message to Jalaluddin Haqqani through, you know, people that had worked with him or had assisted him who are now members of government, you know, in Afghanistan. It didn't work. We were never able to get through to him. And I was told, actually, ultimately, that even if we could, he was not going to influence his son's decision to release David. That was Siraj Haqqani, who was in control of David, and that the younger generation just kind of was doing their own thing. There wasn't necessarily that same kind of level of looking to the elders for advice or for approval.
Well, that would be my contradiction number 37B, maybe. The fact that the Rode family in New York was trying to reach old friend, essence of goodness, Haqqani.
Exactly.
And the State Department was putting his son on a, you know, raising the bounty on his head.
Yes, in the middle of our negotiations or attempted negotiations, yeah. Yeah, the bounty was raised from $200,000 to $5 million. And we had word back, you know, through emissaries and whatnot, that Siraj really believed we had $5 million. We didn't quite understand why. And then we were told, you know, oh, he sees that, you know, if you'll pay $5 million for him, of course you would pay that for one of your own citizens.
But, Chris, some might argue that that's not a contradiction in the fact that, you know, one reporter manages to get himself kidnapped by the Haqqani shouldn't stop the U.S. government from pursuing.
That's true. That's true.
The Haqqanis who've carried out, you know, the largest attacks in Kabul are absolutely brutal to people in North Waziristan, where I was held captive, and brutal to people in eastern Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. You know, beheading basically anybody who's working with the government. Mm-hmm.
And I guess it underscores the fact that our government does not negotiate. You know, they won't release prisoners. They won't pay money. So I guess it really sends that message or underscores it.
I just don't think we Americans have spent enough time reflecting on the fact that we once celebrated our alliance with these hothead Mujahideen, this wonderful line in Muhammad Hanif's book, Case of Exploding Mangoes, where he said, you know, a happy Muj is a guy with a rifle in one hand and, you know, a prayer book in the other. And we've got them. And they're, you know, they're in this Wild West game in Afghanistan. They're giving the Soviets fits. We love these guys. We married them. But so many ironies here. Another one, for example, David, you quote a former ISI official, Pakistani intelligence, saying, apropos the suicide bombings coming at the Pakistan establishment now, you say exactly what Muhammad Hanif said to us the other day in a conversation from Pakistan. He said his agency, ISI, heavily funded over the years by the United States, had lost control of the militants that it had nurtured over the last 30 years. He said, we indoctrinated them and told them, you will go to heaven. These militants, the people holding you, were in a sense trainees in the ISI American-funded project.
We, in a sense, divorced left our you know, fundamentalist wife in the middle of the 90s. I'm just trying to – there is no question that we are absolutely responsible for starting all this in the 80s and happily funded them and happily funded the madrasas and encouraged the Saudis to bring this very vehement and venomous form of Islam to Pakistan. But I guess I'm just – you know, this is my personal frustration with the ISI, and I felt that – you know, I was held captive for so long, and the war has, you know, there's numerous problems with it, but one of the main ones is that these sanctuaries exist in Pakistan, and the Taliban are able to courtesy the ISI, to sit there and wait. And I think Pakistanis, you know, more than anyone else, Pakistanis are dying as a result of this policy of the ISI. I mean, this morning, a bomb went off in Lahore, and at least 7 people were killed who were Shia Muslims, who, you know, these groups have... And I agree. It's a tragedy. It's cynicism on our part. It's, you know, it's cost so many lives, so many Afghan and Pakistani lives, many, many more than American lives. And I feel for Pakistanis that are sort of stuck with this, you know, this Frankenstein that the U.S., you know, helped create. And then some people in the Pakistani military continue to nurture.
The contradictions keep piling up. I just want to introduce this large subject of the drones in the American war. The weirdest part about the drones in your book, David and Kristen, was believing that your guards, your enemies, believed that you, David Rode, were a target of the drones. They believed that U.S. officials wanted to kill you because your death would eliminate the leverage and credibility that the Haqqani network had simply by holding you. A, can that possibly have been true? And B, is not everything about the use of drones counterproductive?
I think the drones are like a manifestation of basically a failed policy. They're sort of this half measure to try to hold these groups in check because the Pakistani military won't confront them themselves. I mean, they disrupt the Taliban's operations. There's no question in my mind based on what I saw myself. They do not gather in large groups. They the drone strikes that occur while I was in captivity, each strike or the vast majority of strikes killed a Taliban leader or a foreign militant, you know, but the Taliban, I believe, exaggerate the number of civilian casualties and then use them as a recruiting tools. I mean, I see them.
Well, I'm sure they exaggerated, but I'm sure we exaggerate the hits, too.
I was there, Chris, and they deeply feared the drones. They you know, Baitullah Massoud was an incredibly vicious man who led the Pakistani Taliban, who, you know, killed Benazir Bhutto and killed hundreds, if not thousands, of Pakistani civilians in his bomb strikes. He died in a drone strike. I'm not saying drone strikes are the answer, but they're sort of a very troubling way to kind of put a finger in a leaking dam. You know, they see them as cowardly, but I do think that and I know that many Pakistanis oppose them, but the Pakistani government supports this. The drones are flown from Pakistani military bases. Anyway,
when they pointed to a, you know, what looked like a Piper Cub up in the sky, David, and they were holding you. What was your own emotional reaction to the sight and the sound of a drone?
It sort of haunts you. I mean, you don't know when. I mean, at first you're sort of afraid because you just don't know when the strike's going to happen. There's no warning. It's the missile comes down faster than the speed of sound, so you know you won't hear the missile that kills you. They circle for hours. After a while, you sort of get used to them, and you don't pay as much attention to them. But it's a devastating weapon, and that you don't know where. It can be circling overhead. It can cover several square miles, and you have no idea when a strike will come.
But what was your fundamental response? Was it help is on the way, or holy shit, this could take me out too?
It changed with time, and it's my view of my captors changed. I want to be honest. I came to just despise them. I hated them. I hated them for what they were doing to my family. I hated them for the fact that they were essentially making my wife and my parents and my siblings feel like that they were just cheap people. And if they could somehow come up with the millions of dollars they wanted, that, you know, my family could save my life. Kidnappings are really, you know, an incredibly personal crime. And so in the beginning, I was sort of concerned by them. But as time went by, if the drones were killing Taliban, it frankly made me happy. Mm-hmm. I saw them as, you know, hypocritical criminals who were doing horrible things to my family. I had made a terrible mistake and put myself in this, you know, position, and, you know, we can talk about it more, but by the end of my captivity, I was, you know, we tried to escape because we were basically ready to die, and we wanted them to get nothing. We wanted our families to not have to suffer like this, and we just completely despised them. So my views of the drone changed over time.
And our view of the drone on the outside was very naive. I mean, we assumed, okay, we have these drones. Why can't they just find David? You know, we had all these stories from security teams that were former government workers that said, you know, the technology now, you can see the whisker on a cat from, you know, but if you don't know where the cat is, it doesn't matter. And we were just shocked that I had a very senior U.S. military official tell me 6 months into the kidnapping that they knew David was in the Mirin Shah area, which, you know, but they didn't have a fix on his location. And I asked, you know, how big is this area? And he said 20 square miles. So it was like finding a needle in the haystack. They couldn't find bin Laden and they couldn't find David.
Well, just on this matter of drones, let me say, your captors come through loud and clear as thugs, David. There's no question about that. Abu Tayyib especially, maybe. I mean, this is a man who seizes every vicious thug's advantage. He's a liar. It's not clear who he is, even what his real name is. And yet there's a moment when I felt, even in your account, a sympathetic vibration. Abu Tayyib weeps at a radio news broadcast about civilian deaths in Afghanistan. Presumably a drone strike on a wedding party. We read about them too. But you feel his pain. You feel his furious anger, maybe for generations, an anger that's going to keep striking back at us. Was there a bridge of sympathy there for that moment with you?
I did for that moment, but then when my guards cheered the attacks on the hotels in Mumbai, they said all the civilians, women and children deserved to die there because everybody in those hotels was, they thought, fornicating with prostitutes. They gleefully cheered when a suicide bomb was set off at a mosque in a different part of the border area, and 70, you know, Pakistani Muslims were killed as they supplicated to God. None of us obviously should kill civilians. It's horrific the number of civilians that the United States has killed in these bomb strikes, but most tracking, including by the UN. And I'm not justifying this at all. I'm just saying the Taliban have killed more civilians in their suicide attacks than the U.S. has killed. We're all wrong. It's absolutely, you know, a fool's approach to be killing civilians when you're waging war. And it won't work, and there will be endless revenge. But I do feel like the Taliban are less careful when it comes to killing civilians than the United States military. And I'm sure there'll be disagreements on that, but the numbers are higher for the Taliban. That's according to the UN tracking in Afghanistan. And they, you know, it's and you know, two wrongs don't make a right. I'm not at all trying to justify what the U.S. has done, but you know, I've seen the other side of it and seen what they've how they terrorize civilians as well. It's a look. There's no military solution here. I meant to say earlier, what's going on with Pakistan and supporting and allowing this Taliban sanctuary to exist, it's all about these tensions between India and Pakistan. You know, the Pakistani military thinks the U.S. will abandon the region. Again, the history lesson, because we abandoned the region in the 1990s. So they think our patience will run out and they'll be left, Pakistan, alone facing India. And they think India is trying to take over Afghanistan and surround them. So that's why, you know, they back the Taliban. It's all political in the end. You know, you could, you know, the military efforts are a fool's errand, I guess you could argue. But it's you know, it's just a tragedy.
How do you end a fool's errand is the question. But take it back to my original question and imagine that strangers or grandchildren, as I say, are asking it in a historical way sometime from now. Why are we in Afghanistan with a policy that was misconceived, we all acknowledge, from the beginning and hasn't worked? What are we doing now?
I mean, I would say the best answer is we're trying to reverse a mistake we made in the 1980s where we unleashed religious fundamentalism. You know, religion in moderation, you know, and can be a, you know, I think a positive force in the world. But when it's twisted and goes to extremes and used for political and military purposes, it's a disaster and it's dangerous and it can't be controlled. And I would like to think that that's what, you know, that's the most optimistic interpretation of what we're mm-hmm. trying to do. How we're going about it is in many ways contradictory and counterproductive. But, you know, that's
philosophy is no longer limited to just Afghanistan. I mean, you know, that whole way of thinking. And
I've seen, I mean, the sad thing about this experience was that, you know, I told my captors, you know, it was Christian, you know, ultra-nationalists in Bosnia that detained me there and, you know, and accused me of, you know, falsely accusing them of massacring Muslims. They did massacre Muslims. I mean, so I saw Christian fundamentalists carry out, you know, horrific crimes in Bosnia. Hmm. When I was based in India, I saw Hindu fundamentalists, you know, carry out horrific crimes against Muslims. In Sri Lanka, I saw Sinhalese Buddhists, you know, do vicious things to the Tamil Hindu minority. So I've seen every major faith taken to an extreme and used for political purposes and used as a justification to do inhuman things. And, you know, I think any faith and, you know, I'm a skeptic about religion still, you know, but whatever God there is, you know, I think any true religion would make us, you know, A, more humble about ourselves and our existence, and B, you know, make us more sympathetic towards fellow human beings. Hmm. And I've seen every faith do the opposite of that when taken to extremes. Each one of these groups thought they were the chosen people defending their faith and culture from outside assault. You know, Christians in Bosnia, you know, Hindus in India, Buddhists in Sri Lanka, and obviously Taliban, you know, Muslim extremists in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it's tragic, but they all had this same sort of siege mentality.
But isn't it the siege and that outside assault that gets this whole madness started? Isn't that maybe where the unwinding has to begin, the cure has to begin?
You mean our own fears of our own siege here, that mm-hmm. this just one, my gosh, if one bomb goes off in Times Square, it will be the end of our society as we know it.
Well, that to begin with, and then the notion that a military intervention will teach them a lesson or make things better or get the bad guys or stop the madness, which, of course, it never does. It seems to me the American presence in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, the support for their military, the feeding of their military machine is much closer to the root of the problem.
I think there are some of these you know, young suicide bombers and some of these people that have been so brainwashed that I don't think there is an option other than using force. I don't think they're going to, you know, if they believe it is their religious duty to forcibly convert, you know, everyone, you know, arguably in the world to their version of Islam, that they're, you know, not interested in negotiating. And I think you, you know, there are, you know, we'll have a conversation about, I guess, just war or not.
Well, I'm thinking of force. Force is one thing, but limited force, local force, force from your own neighbors. As soon as it starts coming from, you know, American aircraft or drones, it's something else.
I agree with you about local force and my kind of, and I'm sure there's holes you can pick in it, mm-hmm. but this absolutely local force, absolutely. How do we support the moderates in these countries more quietly, more respectfully, and more effectively over the long term? The answer isn't, you know, a huge surge of 100,000 troops and spending $100 billion a year. And the answer isn't simply walking away from, you know, these countries and after we've created this mess. And that we've got to be kind of more even-handed and consistent in our approach, you know, over time.
Kristen, do you agree with that?
I do, but, you know, I actually have a question for David.
Uh-oh.
No, I mean, just in talking about how, you know, things are so unstable in Afghanistan on the ground and what are we doing wrong, but I also think there's been civil war there a long time and there was a whole tribal structure which is no longer in place. And how does that play into the confusion of dealing with the region?
That's what Chris was talking about earlier, and that if you believe Afghans, and I don't think it was all perfect, but mm-hmm. before the 1979 Soviet invasion, there was a pretty strong tribal structure. There, mm-hmm. there was a, you know, basically a monarchy that was fairly stable. And it's when this kind of outside imperial rivalries mm-hmm. destabilize the region, you know, the Soviets and Americans coming
in. Right, with the tribal, yeah.
And you know, we weaken the tribal system by supporting these young Mujahideen fighters like Jalaluddin Haqqani. And then the Taliban themselves have decimated the tribal system.
Yes,
they have.
They
saw
killed the elders.
Yeah, they saw it as a primary threat. They want the mullahs to rule mm-hmm, society. They mm-hmm. don't want tribal elders to do it. And in many ways, it's a fight for political power. And that's, you know, why they want to basically use Islam to control the country and strengthen themselves.
Yeah.
You know, they've killed hundreds of tribal elders on both the Pakistani and Afghan
and
side
it's
of the
younger
border.
Generation that's doing that now. Yes.
And you know, there's the concern is that it's this younger generation that's sort of grown up in this jihad that the U.S. created in the 80s and Pakistan continued supporting, I'm sorry, and the Pakistani military continued supporting the 90s. And now even the Pakistani military has lost control of them.
Yeah.
Mm. Good question. Good answer.
Still comes back to us, I guess.
Well, it is, and I'm trying to not sound. I mean, I'm not trying to be simplistic. I just don't. You know, Afghans are not inherently. You know, it wasn't always chaos in that country. You know, yes, they've always fought foreign armies that come in, but they did have their own system and their own structure. And I just try to stay away from this tendency to kind of view foreign countries as.
Right.
Chaotic and hapless and American sort of exceptionalism. And I wish we're just so active in all these regions. We give all this money to different, you know, militaries and governments. And I wish we could just simply withdraw. I don't think we will. And so I guess I'm trying to arguing that we should change how we interact with these regions and that we won't. Because of concerns about energy and oil, you know, we'll never just be able to completely disengage from the world, but to you know, interact in a kind of smarter, much more longer term way.
Stand way back, both of you. Mohammed Hanif, extraordinary writer, Exploding Mangoes and all that, and a great journalist too, remarked to us the other day that none of the rationales you hear, I mean, nobody believes any of the stories anymore. The United States is not there to stabilize Afghanistan. The Pakistani army is not there to protect the security of its people. I mean, everybody says, you know, give me a break. If you were starting again as global citizens to do something constructive for a part of the world in real turmoil and trouble, what would you do? We hand you the magic wand, Kristen, and then you, David.
Yeah. I would empower the women. I know it's pretty predictable that I might say that.
No, but it's true.
Yeah. I think, you know, women, there's a sense, more of a sense of wanting to build a community. They want their kids to be educated. I think educating the women, giving them opportunities, whether it's through like microfinance institutions and helping them have some kind of way of providing for their families. And then I also think education, literacy is a big thing because, you know, how do you get information to people? I know there's radio, actually, and film, but if people kind of don't understand the messages being given to them and can't, you know, read information from other sources, I think it's a problem.
Hmm.
So literacy and empowering the women. Yeah.
David?
I would focus as intensely as possible also behind the scenes to try to reduce tensions between India and Pakistan. It's like a cancer that hangs over that region. And the Pakistani military, you know, uses the threat of these tensions with India as a way to continue its, you know, domination of the country. Afghanistan is just one sort of playing field in that rivalry. But it's holding back the entire region. I think there's a younger generations of Afghans and Pakistanis that see through that and realize how it's holding them all back.
David Rode, Kristen Mulvihill, it's a huge privilege to talk with you as freely as this. Thank you for the book, A Rope and a Prayer. And thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.